You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the Thrive podcast series hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Dave Chapman, and I will be the host of today's podcast. In this episode, we'll review the maintenance therapy for patients with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis and how to manage treatment-related adverse events to optimize an individual's quality of life. Joining me today is Dr. Lisa Arkin, Director of Pediatric Dermatology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in Wisconsin. Welcome, Dr. Arkin.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Oh, it's our pleasure. I'd like to just pick your brain, ask you a few questions. The first would be in those patients with moderate to severe disease, do you have a time interval in mind as a goal between flares?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So in general, the goal is always to reduce the number of flares to keep patients comfortable and allow them really to live their lives without having the burden of this disease. But I'm not sure for me that this is a specific number of weeks or months between flares. It's usually a little more complicated than that. So, you know, for me, it's the severity of the flare. It's how quickly you can identify and treat it. It's how fast you get patients off the roller coaster, right? Which we call the roller coaster of atopic dermatitis when it's flaring. It's how impactful their disease is when it's flaring. It's how much they itch. It's how well they sleep. It's how well they learn and function. Most of the time, for me, this is more of a gestalt rather than like a quantitative number, but it's about, you know, really listening to what the patients and parents tell you rather than keeping track of kind of discrete time between intervals. And most of the time when you see patients back, often you know, they call and say, I'm flaring, I need help. And then you see them back. But sometimes it's like, well, I had a few flares, but we got them treated really quickly. And I think those things are quite different again when we're trying to figure out, like, do we need more or should we move to the next agent?
Great. Thank you. I have a question in regards to treatment. In patients with severe atopic dermatitis, how do you determine which systemic therapy that you think would be most appropriate, whether it's immunosuppressants or JAK inhibition or monoclonal antibodies or just what you mentioned? Now you have a whole litany of things to choose from. How do you make those decisions?
Right. That is like the million-dollar question, right? That's the calculus we often are faced with every day now. And I think, you know, sometimes it comes down to something as simple as the age of the patient. So for example, the JAK inhibitors are only FDA approved for ages 12 and up, whereas dupilumab is now FDA approved down to 6 months. Sometimes it's the comorbidity profile of the patient, right? If they have asthma, allergic rhinitis, food allergies, I often will reach first for dupilumab, particularly in a child, because now we have really mounting evidence that the drug is not just fixing the skin, it's reducing the global Th2 signature, and it's now on label, right, for both atopic dermatitis, asthma, and eosinophilic esophagitis. Now, for example, if they have alopecia areata or vitiligo, which, you know, are really a different immune pathway, often I'll try to reach for a JAK inhibitor. And that's because this targeted treatment will leverage both immunologic pathways. So it's sort of the idea of, can we kill two birds with one stone? And I think we're still really kind of balancing the risk benefit, knowing that we have a lot of safety data for dupilumab at this point. We have reassuring safety data for the JAK inhibitors, but it's still very short term. And these are drugs we need to continue to exercise caution with. And that's because there's a real black box warning on all of them based on the rheumatoid arthritis data, which really took about a decade to unfold. And so I think, you know, when we make the decision to reach for one of those agents, we need good reason and, you know, really good kind of shared decision-making with patients and families about, you know, what the known and potential risks are. And then I would say, you know, I still do use systemic immunosuppressive therapy. I don't reach for it for most patients because, you know, my rationale is, why would I use a non-FDA approved agent when I have an FDA approved one with good safety and efficacy data? But there is some benefit to some of those agents, you know, really to cool patients down quickly when they're, you know, in the middle of a serious hot flare. And sometimes I'll use it because the insurance companies are still requiring step therapy before they will, you know, cover the more expensive biologic. And that's infuriating because all of those systemic immunosuppressives really have long-term risks and they're bridge therapy. So we sort of get there anyway, but I still think there is a place in our arsenal for use of those, even though they're just not good long-term options. And we really use them more as a bridge.
Great. It's a similar type of question. That if a patient with atopic dermatitis does not respond to systemic immunosuppressants, from your experience, are they more likely to respond to dupilumab or tralokinumab versus JAK inhibitors? Or there's really no, I suppose, gestalt, or I know there's no biomarker that I'm aware of that you can use to direct your decision?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like, I love this question so much because I think it really gets to the heart of like, is there going to be a precision-based therapy for every patient and risk factors where we can say this drug's going to work better for you than another? I mean, I think in general, the first question I'm always asking myself, particularly for patients who are failing, you know, systemic immunosuppression or even a biologic is, you know, do I have the right diagnosis, right? Like making sure that you have the right diagnosis and you're not, you know, using the right drug to treat the wrong disease is kind of paramount here. And the way I sort of walk through that is to say, you know, one, could I be missing an allergic contact dermatitis, knowing that, you know, that really doesn't respond particularly well to either biologics or systemic immunosuppression because they're just constantly being re-exposed. You know, could I actually be looking at cutaneous lymphoma, which can be notoriously difficult to diagnose based on a single biopsy, you know? And for me, that's like really looking at the distribution. Lymphoma often is concentrated on the buttock area. It has a different characteristic, but you know, it's easy to miss. So you want to make sure you're not missing that and they're just not getting better because you're actually using the wrong drug for their disease. And then I think in young children in particular with severe atopic dermatitis, I'm always considering the possibility that I could be looking at primary immunodeficiency manifesting with severe atopic dermatitis. And this is really important because immunodeficient patients with atopic dermatitis will get sicker if you give them global immunosuppressive therapy. But knowing the genotype can predict your response to targeted therapy. So for example, for hyper-IgE syndrome, which is caused by now a whole array of genetic mutations, including STAT3, dupilumab is really now our targeted agent of choice. It's safe and it's been reported to help, you know, not just atopic dermatitis, which is a clear manifestation of that disease, but even unusual cutaneous manifestations of the syndrome. So I think the first question I'm always like is, oh, is it really eczema? What else could I be missing? But in answer to your second question, because we absolutely do have patients who fail one agent or another, and I think it's a really critical question. It probably is the question of the future, right? How do we find the right drug for the right patient that's most personalized? And I think atopic dermatitis is such a heterogeneous disease, right? It differs from patient to patient, depending on age, depending on ancestry, depending on genetics, and even response to treatment can be variable. And as you said, you know, we don't yet have a biomarker that will say, you know, this is the drug for you. And so we don't really know, you know, what patient subgroup will respond better to one biologic, like, you know, Dupi versus a JAK. But I think it probably is one of the critical research questions over the next decade, which which will drive better understanding for how to reach the most effective personalized therapy for every individual patient. And, you know, the first step in that is defining the spectrum and creating, you know, classifications that include biomarkers to say, you know, this is the immune signature in this cohort of patients, you know, and for that reason, we would expect response to this targeted therapy to be better. But it's a really difficult question to disentangle just because it's not one disease. It's so broad.
Mm-hmm. Now that makes complete sense. I'm curious, in regards to your patients and educating around treatment-related adverse events for, say, the monoclonal antibodies or, well, focusing on those. Otherwise, we'd have you talking for an hour. Yeah. are there certain side effects that you educate your patients to, oh, be aware of this? Or, you know, it's that can be that school of thought where you don't want to tell them too much because then they start to anticipate it, or you want to inform them so they know if it happens, what, how to recognize it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that, I think that's, you know, that's our job as physicians, right? Just to say, like, here's what I want you to watch for. Don't go down the rabbit hole for the less than 1% side effect. But I think, you know, for Dupi and tralokinumab, probably conjunctivitis is the side effect we worry about the most. We know it occurs in a higher incidence of Dupi-treated atopic dermatitis patients relative to placebo and also with tralokinumab. But interestingly, the rates of conjunctivitis in the asthma trials were actually similar for both Dupi and placebo. So it must be intrinsically related, you know, to the population with atopic dermatitis. I mean, the good thing is most patients who are affected are usually mild to moderate. And actually, most of the time, we just continue the drug. And interestingly, it just goes away, like it improves. And so there's a lot of sort of conjecture and hypothesizing around why that is. And I think, you know, the working theory is that the antibody is sort of blocking the receptor or blocking the decoy receptor, and that leads to transient increased levels of, you know, either IL-4 and 13 or IL-13. And so those transiently increased levels are pretty short term until you get homeostasis and the levels settle. But, you know, we worry about this because in a very small subset of patients and in the clinical trials, it was like less than 1%. You can get a scarring keratoconjunctivitis. And so you really want to pick that up early. It's not something you want to miss. And they've done some pretty good studies on risk factors that can help to identify patients who are at higher risk for developing conjunctivitis. And these include, you know, having worse disease when you start, having a history of previous conjunctivitis. And there are actually a few biomarkers, including, you know, sky-high elevated IgE levels and elevated eosinophil counts, which really probably are markers for disease severity in general. So those can be useful in that they can help us identify the patients you're going to really watch more closely. I think the other thing, because this is something that happens in patients who have a previous history of conjunctivitis, is you want to ask before you put them on, you know, do you have itchy eyes? Do you have gritty eyes? Do you have red eyes? Do your eyes hurt? Because if you do, you know, those are the patients who may come back and say, I have those symptoms, but maybe it's just, you know, they've had it for a long time. And it's really the delta we're worried about, but also, you know, the severity of what you see in front of you. And I often partner with ophthalmology with those patients, mostly because I can. And then I'm not worried about missing something. I'm fortunate to say I've never seen a scarring keratoconjunctivitis. And most of the time, you know, when opto sees these patients, they can put them on drops. And again, the longer you keep them on the drug, the better they do. I think we also see some injection site reactions. Those are pretty easy to treat. You put a topical steroid on it, it's gone. I think in the pediatric population, the monoclonal antibodies are all sub-Q. And so dealing with fear of needles and injection anxiety is definitely a challenge. You know, interestingly, I think my hardest patient population for that is not the little kids, it's the adolescents, you know, who are too big for their parents to say, like, okay, we have to do this. And, you know, then the psychology of that becomes really, you know, I use health psychology to help them, but sometimes we just can't get through it. And then actually having some oral options becomes really important for that patient population. But I think, you know, particularly for the monoclonal antibodies, we have so much reassuring data. And I spend a lot of time talking to families about that, right? So we do not see a cancer signal. We do not see an increased risk for infections, including mm-hmm. COVID-19. And that has been so critical and is so different from the global immunosuppressants where, you know, mm-hmm. we say like, if you're exposed, you have to stop it. And here's when you restart it. And if there's a family member who has it, you know, here's what you do. I mean, that becomes really critical for the JAK inhibitors, for example, because COVID-19 really leverages the type 1 interferon pathway, which is inhibited by those drugs. But the monoclonal antibodies really are different. They're so targeted that they're not going to reduce the immune response. And I think mm-hmm. the last thing that I often talk to young families about is just that we don't have a ton of data on live vaccines. And I think, you know, the companies are working on accruing that data, but for now, you know, we need vaccines. Vaccines keep kids from getting, you know, life-threatening communicable illnesses. But we're still sort of holding that dose, you know, a month before the vaccine is given and a month after. And those are usually pretty easy to get around. And it's a very small subset of vaccines. It's MMR and varicella. Those are really our only live vaccines. So that's pretty much what I spend my time talking to families about. A lot of reassurance and saying, you know, I want to know if his or her eyes are red and itchy and gritty, but you know, 99% of the time we get through it.
Maybe you can use Halloween candy to divert the child's attention, and while they're trying to chew on a Tootsie Roll Pop, they can you can hit them with a sub-Q injection.
I mean, I could do a whole podcast on all the things we've tried. You know, my nurse spending 3 hours with a 15-year-old in the room, like, you know, to incentivizing and candy and Emla and lidocaine and ice. And but it's
oh man,
What I really think would help is if we could inject, you know, create sort of the painless injection, right? Maybe it sprays cryotherapy like our lasers do right before the shot comes so they don't feel it. But mm-hmm. alas, not yet invented. So we'll have wait on it.
Yeah. Yep. All right. One last quick question. Wanted to pick your brain around sequencing therapy, or actually drilling a little further down. If one of your patients doesn't respond to, say, a monoclonal antibody, would you try the other, or the same with a JAK inhibitor? If one of the kids doesn't respond to a JAK inhibitor, would you try another? Or is that pretty much, if they don't respond to one, then that precludes trying any other agents in that class?
Yeah, I mean, I think we actually have a fair amount of data, even from psoriasis, showing it's not always a class effect. And so, for example, I mean, tralokinumab isn't approved in my population yet because it's really adults. But I think a lot of my adult colleagues will say, if you fail Dupi, we are going to try tralokinumab. And I think some of those patients have responded. And why that is sort of an interesting area of research. An investigation. The JAK inhibitors are all a little different too, right? Because there are three JAK receptors and each one of them hits a different one, right? Like UPA's primarily JAK1, TOFA's 1 and 3, although tofacitinib is not approved for atopic dermatitis, but they hit a slightly different receptor. And so I think in general, you know, if you fail one, it doesn't necessarily, we don't yet really have the data to say you'll fail them all. But I think I do a lot of sort of add-on therapy before I switch agents. So for example, you know, we use a lot of light with dupilumab or some of these other agents, just because then you're not, you know, adding to the systemic therapy. You're using a safe local immunotherapy, if you want to call it, but, you know, you're reducing the immune cells in the skin using light, which means you're not adding risk to the patient. Or, you know, sometimes even at the start of therapy, we will kind of use a systemic immune suppressant like cyclosporin, for example, because it works so fast. And then bridge to dupilumab or bridge to another agent, and cyclosporine and JAKs don't go well together. You're augmenting the immunosuppression, but there are some really good publications looking at, you know, the timing for bridge. And typically in adults, it's about 3 to 4 months as you get the dupi on board and you can sort of taper down on the cyclosporine. I think in my practice, I'm usually able to get patients off by about 8 weeks. But I think I do that more commonly, and then I'll try other things like adding light, or, you know, if it's really localized disease, some of the new topical targeted agents like topical ruxolitinib, which is now FDA approved for atopic dermatitis, that can be a very helpful add-on. Or thinking about, you know, could there be a pterosporum component? Where, you know, they get a lot of head and neck dermatitis. And that actually, if you look in the blood and you see an elevated IgE level, you can treat it with fluconazole for 6 weeks and they get better. So, you know, before I'm just sort of piling on second agents, I'm always saying, like, is there something else reversible that I'm missing? Or do they just need a little bump for the drug to keep working? But that said, I do think there are patients who fail, and then there's not necessarily a contraindication to saying, let's just try another agent in the same class before we move on.
Great. That's very helpful. Appreciate your time, Dr. Arkin. Our podcast has come to close. And I want to thank you. Also want to thank our listeners for joining us. And we will hope you will listen to other episodes of the Thrive Atopic Dermatitis podcast series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians, nurses, and other healthcare practitioners. I would like to also give a special thank you to our grant supporters, Sanofi and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity.